Okay, I'm going to call the meeting, the Long-Term Care Division Committee to order. And we have a quorum as president. So in your packet, you should have the minutes from March 25th. And I'm looking for a motion to approve the minutes from those who were present. Okay, thank you. Representative Mason moves the minutes. Any discussion? Everyone have time to review those? Okay. Everyone in favor of approving the minutes for March 25th, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, same sign. Okay, minutes approved and adopted. Okay, so I want to welcome, we have a new member here with us, Representative Hunter Cantrell. Welcome to the Long-Term Care Division. We're very excited to have you here. We know you have relevant bills, so we're excited to hear those bills this session as well. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Well, hello, members, and thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Representative Hunter Cantrell. I represent Ola Savage in the northwest portion of Burnsville. I really am excited to join you for the work that we're going to take a look at this session. My background prior to joining the legislature was that I worked for several years as a personal care assistant, home care worker, and direct support staff. So this is an area that I care quite a bit about, and I'm looking forward to seeing how we can kind of work to overcome some of the issues that that we've experienced in ensuring that everybody has access to sustainable and affordable long-term care options. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Well, welcome back, everybody. We're going to be very busy this session. So as you know, we only meet once a week, and we are going to stick to that schedule. The first committee deadline is March 13th, so we will prioritize the bills, the policy bills that we think will move through both the House and the Senate. So if you have new bills, please talk to our committee administrator, Chris McCall, to my right, about scheduling those bills before our calendar fills up. Today, I'll give you a roadmap first of what we're going to do this session. So first, we're going to hear from the agencies for updates. Today and the following weeks, we're going to talk about increasing access to long-term care insurance products. We got a preview of this last year. We're going to look at unlocking new dollars for nursing homes that target specific goals like lowering operational costs and driving workforce interest. We're going to look at the elderly waiver program and try to bolster that program. How can we improve it? There'll be a financial implication for that, so we'll see how far we can get this year and tee it up for next year if we're not successful getting a budget target. We're going to continue searching for ways to stabilize our PCA workforce shortage issue and wages, and then we'll look at greater flexibility for accessing current programs like essential community supports. And then we'll be hearing individual bills on different topics in long-term care and on disability issues. So before we start with the commissioners, does anyone have any questions or comments? Okay, let's bring down Commissioner Malcolm from Department of Health. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Thank you so much. I'm Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. And it's a pleasure to be with you today to give you kind of a progress report on all the work that we have been doing over these last couple of years to improve our operations in the Health Regulation Division, specifically those programs dealing with oversight of facilities and providers serving our elderly and people with disabilities, vulnerable Minnesotans who reside in long-term care services settings. So today I just want to give you a really quick update on some of the progress we've made and forecast what's coming in the next couple of years. As you know, our mission at the Health Department is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans, and certainly our regulatory functions are a very key aspect of that mission. You know very well kind of the history of the increasing legislative attention that's been brought to bear on particularly oversight of the facilities serving some of our most vulnerable populations and appropriate scrutiny on whether the Department of Health's complaint investigation functions were keeping pace, which they frankly were not, with the growing volume of reports that we have been receiving. We were falling behind in building up quite a backlog in reviewing and investigating reports, both those reports that are made by the facilities themselves and reports filed directly by consumers. That led to a lot of media attention, as you well know, legislative concern, commissioner transitions, reports being made to Governor Dayton in 2018 from an important group of consumer organizations, as well as the legislative auditor. The legislature, stakeholders, all of us spent a lot of time in 2018 talking about policy solutions, but ultimately no bill was passed that year. In the fall of 2018, I convened along with colleagues at DHS and the Office of the Ombudsman, some informal working groups that just were tremendous in terms of the amount of time and expertise that they contributed to the process, leading us to bring you during the 2019 session, a work in progress to modernize our regulatory system governing assisted living facilities in particular. And that bill passed with extraordinary bipartisan support, thanks to the fact that the stakeholders were so deeply engaged and worked so hard to reach agreements on complex issues. So what we have been doing really since passage of the legislation, I'm very grateful, and we're going to get into a little bit of budget overview in a minute, but just very grateful for the legislature's acknowledgement that in addition to modernizing the regulatory framework, we also needed resources to really strengthen our base operations. And what we've been doing has been really to fundamentally redesign our processes for taking in reports, investigating those reports, triaging them so that we can get to the most significant reports first. We've done some staff reorganizing, which I'll go over with you in a few minutes, because I really am proud of that work and think it's exactly what we should be doing when we learn difficult lessons about what's not going well. We have, as I mentioned, done some reorganizing. I'll go over that in a minute. We have done, really dug in with continuous improvement methodology, building off of the tremendous partnership we had with the Department of Human Services and what we learned from them about embedding continuous improvement principles in our work to, as we were really overhauling the Office of Health Facility Complaints, also did a very similar process in our home care regulatory arena, which has yielded some great process improvements there as well. In addition, we took a look at the whole, we are continuing to take a look at the whole health regulation division, one of the largest and most complicated divisions with inside the health department, to try to really take some of these lessons to heart and generalize them across our health regulation functions. And we have continued all this time to work very closely with engaged stakeholders to make sure that as we continue these operational improvements and as we implement new policies passed by the legislature, that we're doing that with the expertise and the perspective of stakeholders embedded throughout. In terms of operational improvements within the Office of Health Facility Complaints, specifically that unit of the department that was set up in law to really take in reports from facilities and consumers, you can see on this graphic how the number of investigations on filed reports, 21,000 reports filed in 2019, how the number of investigations has gone up. Also, the percentage of times that we substantiate findings when we do go out to do on-site investigations has gone up. And very importantly, the average number of days to close of those reports that are subject to on-site investigation has fallen and continues to fall pretty significantly. So a lot of the process improvement that we've been doing is showing in the numbers. We continually array a dashboard, sort of a report card, on our website so folks can see at any given time what's going on in terms of the number of reports that we're receiving, what the disposition of those reports are, what the type of reports are. And I think that dashboard itself came out of the conversation that we had with the legislature about the need for more transparency and more public accountability. And this is an excerpt from the year-end dashboard. This is specific to reports filed under the terms of the Vulnerable Adults Act in Minnesota. And as you can see, there were over 21,000 total reports filed in 2019. Important, though, to distinguish that those reports are of two types. I think we haven't always done a good job of distinguishing that not all of these 21,000 reports are complaints about something bad that's happened. The largest percentage of the reports come from facilities themselves who are responsible to report problems or potential problems. Even if those problems are readily addressed by the facility, they still need to report to MDH when something has happened or potentially has happened. But you can see on this chart the degree to which the largest numbers of reports are coming from facilities themselves compared to reports or typically referred to as complaints filed by individual consumers or their concerned loved ones. You can see also on this dashboard that the Vulnerable Adults Act defines maltreatment as either neglect, abuse, or financial exploitation. And then there's another category of general compliance issues. And you can see that neglect remains the most frequent type of allegation, but that there are increasing numbers of reports or complaints from consumers that more of those complaints are actually coming regarding home care providers than nursing homes. Remembering that until passage of the new law, assisted living facilities were not a designated category in the law. The next couple of slides, just for your reference, I won't read them to you, but I think it's always helpful.
I'm going to stop
consumers.
You right there, Commissioner Malcolm, for a question. Representative Munson has a question on the last slide. I believe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the number of the 21,000 reports on that slide, I just wanted to clarify, when you say that the facilities are reporting the bulk of these complaints, is that the facility in a report that they're required to send, or could it be, is it an individual worker in the facility that may be reporting something? Where are they bucketed?
I believe that reports from a worker within a facility would be counted as a facility report. I'm checking with my staff. That is correct. So
okay.
Could be the administrator or it could be a worker within the facility.
Okay.
And it's something that the facility or the worker knows has happened, like someone lost a wallet or something, is the kind of an example that's often cited, and then the wallet is found the next day.
Okay.
Which is not at all to minimize the significance of these reports, but just to point out that there's a very wide range of types of issues and severity of issues when it comes to harm to consumers.
Okay.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Malcolm. Kind of going off Representative Munson's question, I too am curious as to the instances in which, as you were kind of elaborating on, the instances in which facilities would be reporting on these things. So you mentioned, you actually might have already answered my question a little bit. So someone's wallet goes missing, and then are we talking about other types of incidents where they range in severity from something like a wallet goes missing to outright abuse and neglect? Is that kind of the full spectrum of when these facilities would report?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Cantrell, yes, that's right. I think the important thing about these numbers is just to put in context, it's a very large volume of reports, all of which need to be checked out. And one of the things that I'm the most grateful for to the staff for having worked so hard to correct is that we now have a much stronger triage system in place so that all of these reports have eyes on them very early on. So they're not sitting there and we don't know what it's the lost wallet and what's a potential actual case of harm to a consumer. So that is a very important piece of the story is the importance of identifying quickly which of this large volume of reports requires an on-site investigation to determine what has happened and whether it does or does not meet the statutory definitions of maltreatment, which again is abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation, and which might very well be issues of lack of compliance with a state law or statute, but where no maltreatment has been alleged. So there's just a lot of activity going on in this arena, and I think we don't need to spend time on these definitions, but as we're trying to talk about what are the sort of things that are coming into the reporting system and what are the things that actually get investigated. Part of that triage function is to see whether the report does or does not meet these statutory definitions of abuse, neglect, exploitation. And, you know, a general point that I would make is, as you see, the majority of times the reports that come in do not trigger an on-site investigation, either because it's a facility self-report that's already been cured or it's a problem that doesn't meet these statutory definitions, which, again, doesn't necessarily mean it's not an important issue. So one of our commitments is to take all of this data, all 21,000 reports, and do a better job of understanding what are the issues that are in those reports, not just looking at the investigated reports and the subset of those that are found with on-site investigation to be substantiated with a preponderance of the evidence.
So, you have a follow-up?
For sure.
Commissioner, I have a question. So it's a pretty amazing that your agency, even though you've seen a substantial increase in reporting, that you've been able to reduce the number of days to close. And if you had to add FTEs, or how did you actually resolve this? More reports to follow up on, yep, and closing them quickly.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, thanks for the question. We have been able to add staff thanks to the legislature responding favorably to our request for resources to keep pace with the volume. But the bigger part of the answer is the process improvements that we've been able to do inside the Office of Health Facility Complaints, thanks in no small part to the tremendous partnership we had with the Department of Human Services in 2018 and into 2019. Just a really excellent and thorough reworking of the processes. And you might remember, members, the legislative auditor's report, and I received that within the first few weeks of being on the job in 2018, was just an incredibly valuable diagnostic of what had gone wrong and what the sort of the layers of improvement were that were needed. And we've just been working through that like a checklist and have reported to this committee and others kind of which of those recommendations in the legislative auditor's report have been fully implemented and which are still works in progress. But it really just a whole lot of this was good, solid, continuous improvement reengineering of our processes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll just skip past these definitions, but they are perhaps worth your attention if you're interested in understanding, well, why is it that that you dismiss things that don't fit the definitions? This kind of gives you an insight in the kind of things sort of, if you flip the definition to the reverse, you'll see the sort of things that do not qualify as abuse or neglect or exploitation under our law. We certainly can talk more about that in future if you would like. So to give you a sense, again, of some of how we've made these improvements that we've made, the funding that you authorized, the House and the Senate both prioritized and supported the governor's request for a significant amount of funding in 2019 to do a couple of things. To stand up this new and very important and very complex assisted living licensure statute, a really significant change to our regulatory framework in Minnesota, you supported, and we're so grateful for it, the fact that we needed to stabilize our core operations at the same time. We couldn't build this new assisted living license structure on top of an inadequate base function. So those resources have been very, very helpful to us in improving our capacity, strengthening our systems, and really just being able to have the stability to implement this new law and to produce better, higher quality, more consistent and reliable results in our existing range of regulatory activities. As you might remember, it was a very significant budget ask last year. We were certainly well aware of that, and we were very grateful for your support. These next few slides are just a quick update on what we've done with the resources that you appropriated last summer. One of the reasons that we've been able to improve productivity so significantly is that we've made some enhancements to making more of our processes automated. Those big backlogs were created by a completely paper-based process that was led to not only inefficiencies but real quality problems and not being able to easily look at trend data and understand what was going on. Really building a robust case management system, which is not just one, I want to be clear, it's not one system off the shelf. We're connecting pieces of multiple systems in a way that is much more cost effective to automate the parts of our process, but to let information flow across different systems. So we're working on this case management framework, connecting pieces of our process. That was a significant part of the funding. That project is well underway and will be installed in kind of modules or increments over the next couple of years. There were improvements funded to make improvements to the common online entry point, MARC, the MDH component of that. That is a system, as you know, maintained and overseen by DHS, but to allow a common entry point for different types of facilities to come into MARC required a new online entry point to be created, will be fully in place in just another couple of months here. We're also working, just beginning to start, and we'll kick off a design of a public data reporting website to make it a lot easier for consumers to search our website to use it for understanding information on providers. Increased regulatory capacity was another significant component of the operational improvement funding that you supported, which was to add a survey team to improve the frequency of home care inspections, also critically to appropriately fund the state match requirement for Medicaid-funded work for licensing, certification, and investigation. So you can see there very significant increases in our workforce enabled by that new legislative funding. So we are much, much closer to an appropriate staffing level to meet our timeliness and investigation standards. So that hiring is complete. The next component, I'm very excited about this as well. We requested and you supported some resources to allow us to do more with all this information so that we can do more analytics on the data that's coming into the system, turn that into improvement opportunities, working with providers and working with consumer groups. To be much, much more data focused in our efforts, and to have robust performance metrics that can help us continue to just improve, because we know there remain opportunities for even greater streamlining and systematizing of these functions. I mentioned the Health Regulation Division is one of the most complicated parts of the Health Department. The Health Regulation Division contains, historically was organized around really silos of programs that had been created over many years by legislative action, kind of built around sites of care or types of providers. And the Health Regulation Division was kind of created around programs, many of those programs having very similar functions within them. But each program had its own version of, for instance, triage and report investigation. So we started in early 2019, again, using the improvement lessons learned through the Office of Health Facility Complaints redesign to really look at all of the Health Regulation Division, and have really, I think the staff leaders in that division have done just an excellent job of engaging employees in the division to help redesign the work to be more, not only more efficient, but higher quality as well. And that work is yielding a very different design in this big division, which is going to take several years to fully implement. But I think it's just smart thinking to say, what have we learned? How do we modernize our approach? How do we not just build sort of redundancy within programs, but to look at what are the common needs across the programs so that we can produce better, higher quality, more efficient results for Minnesotans. And this chart, which you probably can see not too well on the screen, but in your hard copies, is inside baseball, but it really, what's happening here is this is replacing a very siloed structure built around each program as though it was a standalone mini agency almost, such that we will be supporting all of those programs with more functionally integrated processes that go across provider types and sites of care. And moving much more to a regional structure where more operations are deployed across the state where these providers are. We're also building, for example, a rapid response team. Occasionally something really, a really complex investigation or the need for sweeping regulatory action. You may remember a couple of highly publicized closures of facilities last year. When something like that happens, it really interrupts the regular flow of day-to-day processing. So instead of, we always know something's going to happen. We just don't know what or where. But now we're building the capacity to have a team of folks that can be deployed to work on a complex regulatory situation so that the day-to-day work continues in a more uninterrupted way. This is an example of the kind of redesign thinking that we've been doing. This was a division that, as the legislative auditor's report pointed out, had a lot of inefficiencies, a lot of gaps, and a lot of morale challenges among the staff. And one of the things I'm the most grateful to the leaders in this division too is the degree to which they've taken those challenges really seriously, engaged staff who are the closest to the work in helping to redesign the work, and the retention, the morale, the productivity are all significantly improving. And I'm much more confident today than I was 2 years ago in the accuracy of the data and the consistency of the results that are being produced by the system. So now I'm going to switch gears and talk about the kind of where we are on implementation of that really significant new law, the assisted living licensure law. Parts of the law are already taking effect of the policy bill that you passed last spring, but the full implementation, the need for facilities to be licensed as an assisted living facility if they're going to hold themselves out as such, that fully takes effect August 1st of 2021. And as you recall, what that really means is that anyone offering assisted living facility services, consumers will have one contract for both their living arrangements and the home care services within that living arrangement instead of having a bifurcated two contracts with two completely differently regulated entities. So that single license, that single contract from a consumer's perspective is an important enhancement in and of itself. The licensure requires certain physical plant requirements and fire safety, an enhanced bill of rights, licensing of assisted living directors, spelled out responsibilities and requirements for the facilities, for the survey investigation process, and pretty significantly enhanced consumer protections. So since the bill was signed in late May, we've done a number of things already. Certain of those consumer protections are already in effect. The enhanced Bill of Rights is in effect. The ability, not the requirement, but the ability to impose immediate fines for egregious problems without waiting for an opportunity to create a corrective action plan. A maltreatment compensation fund, which is a short-term fund until the assisted living licensure system is fully in effect. Directions to the health department about how to prioritize investigations specifically about terminations of service or residency. And electronic monitoring took effect in January 1st. We've continued to, as I mentioned, engage stakeholders and to coordinate this work across DHS, MDH, and the Ombudsman's Office, both to implement the pieces of the law that are already in effect and to plan for a pretty complex transition from today's bifurcated regulatory system into the new single license system. As I mentioned, the Bill of Rights enhancements were effective last summer, and we are prioritizing our compliance and investigation activities accordingly. And clients are now receiving the information in the enhanced Home Care Bill of Rights starting last August and going forward. Electronic monitoring, I know, is something that this committee and others spent a lot of time on over a couple of years, and it is now in place. We partnered with the Office of the Ombudsman to get this electronic monitoring system in place. The consent forms were developed for residents and their representatives in close consultation with consumer groups and facilities. Those consent forms are now in use. They're on the website, along with an explanation on our website of what the law entails, whose responsibilities are what. And I'm happy to say that as far as we've seen so far, it's working pretty well. We've not seen a large volume of complaints reported about the new electronic monitoring system. I'm sure the Ombudsman could give you a more on-the-ground sense of how that's going. Rulemaking. It was a large and complicated bill with a lot of detail in it, but we still needed to do rulemaking to put the law fully into effect, and we did so on a very, very fast timeline, probably a full year and a half faster than rulemaking typically takes. And that was an important part of the agreement reached across the stakeholders, that to get some of these more robust consumer protections in place through the licensure law, we needed to pledge to do everything we could to really move this through the rulemaking process as fast as possible. There have been monthly meetings going on since last October with all hands on deck approach within the department. Lots of folks stepping in to help with the rule writing process across the agency. We need to hit this this timeline to allow for enough clarity in the requirements for providers to make this transition by August of 2021, that these rules are anticipated to be adopted this December, which means, you know, the process of writing, filing, reviewing, hearings, adjustments has to really, really proceed on a very, very tight time schedule in order to hit that December 31st date. There will be, Madam Chair, a very, very kind of tightly prioritized list of technical amendments to the bill that we'll be bringing back to your committee. We're working closely with the stakeholders to make sure that we are identifying only those things that really, really need to be done right now, so that the rules can be completed, or that that providers and consumers can have essential clarity for this important transition period. But certainly with a bill this complex, we know as we implement it, we will learn things, we'll find problems that we haven't yet anticipated, and we know we'll be working on this with you for years to come. But we feel that we are basically on track with implementation, and the pieces that have been implemented so far have gone quite well, and that is thanks still to an extraordinary degree of engagement and partnership with the stakeholders, who continue to work with us in a very collaborative way and with each other to make sure that we can implement this really important policy improvement.
Well, I just want to thank you, Commissioner, for doing all of that work. We really appreciate working together and with the stakeholders, and we look forward to seeing the rules that you've derived with all of the stakeholders as well. So thank you.
With that, Madam Chair, happy to answer questions, and a couple of my technical experts are with me.
Representative Brunhagen?
Oh, sure. I didn't have my hand up, but I got a question. Oh, thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. Yeah, just a suggestion on the rulemaking. If there's one complaint I get in a lot of different areas is that the state makes rules so tight and it's one size fits all. If you can build a little bit of flexibility into them, I think it would be appreciated. And especially sometimes when they make them so tight, it actually increases costs locally and doesn't necessarily produce the desired results. Now, having said that, I understand we have to have rulemaking because obviously we pass the bill and then you have to figure out how to implement it. But it's just a suggestion of input that I get back about some of the state mandates and requirements to build a little bit of flexibility into them. And hopefully we can make this work because we all want to protect our most vulnerable. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Greenhagen, thank you very much. And you're right, that's the essential balance that we have tried to strike all along and will continue to, is the desire for flexibility for providers and consumers, but with more clarity about what it is they're actually buying. So that's that is very much the intent, is to allow for flexibility in what's offered and how, as long as it's certain things are more standardized, but essentially that the information for consumers is much more clear about what they're actually getting.
Yes. And I would hope also that members will contact their facilities in their district to remind them about the public comment period during the rulemaking process, mm-hmm. so that feedback is reaching the agency. Yeah. Representative Gruenhagen?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up. I can't remember. Is there a rating system inside of the rulemaking? There is. Could you comment on that briefly?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, yes, the I'm sorry, I misspoke. It's not rating in terms of payment for services, but the fee structure for the licensure itself is part of the rulemaking.
Oh, okay.
Representative Munson?
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. You and I have had conversations about the bill that was passed last year. I've heard a lot of complaints from my district, especially in small towns that have facilities that are somewhat assisted living and their senior housing. They're very concerned. They don't have nursing on staff, but they offer a daily meal, or they have a bus, and sometimes they fall into this category of now being regulated and are facing more fees. In fact, some have already raised the rates on seniors for housing, and so that's just something we have to be really cautious for going forward. I did have a question for you on slide number 11, which is on page 6 of our presentation here. In that middle block where it says updates to common online entry port for abuse reports, can you explain, is that for people logging complaints of abuse from facilities or for everyone? And is it just abuse or is it also neglect in financial, what the other terminology was, but can you explain how that process is working and is it open to the whole public?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, I believe, but I'm going to invite staff to come and join me at the table if they have more detail to share, that this is for facilities who need to be able to report into MARC so that we can use MARC rather than having a whole separate system for providers to report through, that we needed to design an online way for the facility reports to come in and then be integrated with MARC.
Please introduce yourself to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Krieger. I am the Director of the Office of Health Facility Complaints. Madam Chair, Representative, the question regarding the MARC enhancements and reporting structure, the enhancements that are going to be made for reporting is for facilities to self-report. The MARC system itself is a common entry point for the state of Minnesota, and so if there are consumer complaints, they can go ahead and call the phone number, and it is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There is a mandated website, and so this is for mandated reporters for facilities or for other entities to go in and report that way.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up question. Is there a way for people to report anonymously? And I know that there was maybe discussion about some blowback on whistleblowers that are working in facilities. Is there a way for them to report something anonymously? And then just a second question. For consumers, now that we have more electronic monitoring, people being able to use devices to kind of monitor their grandparent or something, is there a way for people to send that as evidence to as part of their complaint?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, I'd invite Lindsay to answer that one.
Madam Chair, Representative, as far as anonymous reporting, MARC takes anonymous reports or complaints that come in. And I think that there was a question earlier regarding facility staff that are potentially reporting. If a facility staff is reporting on behalf of a complaint, that they can call that into MARC. And so they might not be classified as facility staff at that point, and they're actually making a complaint against the facility. But otherwise, MARC system does take anonymous complaints that come in. And when we triage in our office, no matter who comes in as far as what the complaint is, we look at the allegation as far as the triage determination on that, rather than if it's coming from a specific individual or not. Regarding complaints for electronic monitoring does also come through the MARC system. And so if there is a complaint, we do return calls back to the complainants. And so the MARC system doesn't necessarily take attachments, but as the department, we would reach out and we would have that attachment sent to us.
Okay. It's my understanding that fees have not yet been charged to facilities because the licensure is still going through the rulemaking process. Okay, any other questions? Representative Cleaver?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, in thinking about some of the facilities that are near my home in Plymouth, and some of the businesses that have been that are in Plymouth, the utility companies have been very helpful working with the businesses in improving their energy efficiencies and helping with ways that they can lower their costs of operation through different conservation methods. Do you think this is something that we should be looking into for our nursing homes and also our assisted living facilities as well?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Cleaborn, yes, I think that's one of many things that we're interested in doing more of is connecting resources to these very important care facilities to assist them not only in implementing new facility standards, safety protections, working very closely with the fire marshals, for example, but I think your suggestion about making sure that utility providers are aware of some of the enhancements that are being sought is a great idea.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you for your testimony and for the update. I'm sure we'll see you back here for various bills. So next up, we have Commissioner Harpstead from DHS. She's going to give us the long-term care update from DHS, and Dan Pollack will be on deck. Welcome, Commissioner.
Good afternoon. Chair Schultz, members of the committee, I am Jody Harpstead, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, and going to beg your indulgence in advance. I will be trying not to cough through my entire testimony. As a reminder, before I became Commissioner of DHS, I led Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota, one of the largest nonprofit human service organizations in Minnesota, who's done services for people with disabilities back to 1951. Services for this population accounted for 60% of the total work of that organization. I was also one of the founders of the Altair ACO, an integrated health partnership of now 13 of the largest disability service organizations in Minnesota, serving about a third of all people on HCBS waivers in the state. So I have some thoughts about how life ought to go for people with disabilities in Minnesota. We've all heard that Minnesota was one of the first, if not the first, state to move people with disabilities out of regional treatment centers into the community via four-person homes on neighborhood streets, starting some 40 years ago. To this day, some states still have people in institutions of 20, 30, or more residents, while Minnesota is one of 15 states that have closed all their large institutions. It's my impression, having been in this field for over 15 years, that while Minnesota was indeed a pioneer, as our kids with disabilities grew up mainstreamed in the public schools, some did not want to live in a home with three or more people with disabilities. At the same time, many of those original group home residents have outlived all life expectancy expectations and are aging in place in the homes they have happily lived in now for decades. Minnesota has always stood for choice for people with disabilities. Providers have trained their teams in person-centered planning, and these tools should inform decisions instead of assumptions about how people want to live. And I think it's very important to make this generational distinction. At the same time, some providers did move ahead, offering people new options, like the Hammer apartment model, where people live in their own apartments with 24/7 staff available in the building. Like the LSS host family homes, where adults with disabilities move into a family's home, particularly as they age out of children and youth services. Host homes are designed to provide the life coaching people need to try to live on their own. And in recent years, several providers, including our state-operated services, are moving people with intense needs out of regional treatment centers, crisis hospitals, and other intense settings to community homes with staff, giving them twice the life for half the cost. Minnesota also pioneered sheltered workshops decades ago to give people with disabilities the dignity of work. And some providers, LifeWorks and Opportunity Partners, for example, have moved forward to brokering jobs in integrated settings in the community, like at Walgreens warehouses and then Walgreens stores, sourcing the baggers at Byerly's grocery stores, and many, many more. And we look forward to utilizing employment services under the waiver and implementing our MOU with DEED to support people in new ways. I read a book recently by Minnesota author Kim Nielsen, who explained that when Rosie the Riveter went to work in World War II, so did people with disabilities. And when Rosie was sent back to the kitchen after the war, so were people with disabilities. Our next decade-long workforce shortage in every job category in Minnesota should be a golden opportunity to ask employers to adapt workplaces for people with disabilities to integrate their work into the community in jobs that add to the economy and pay good wages. The development of four-person group homes and sheltered workshops in Minnesota was accomplished in many towns by the employees who had been working in the regional treatment centers, who went on to start family-owned small businesses to create the new models. It's much harder to transform the business of a small business that has done one type of service for decades than to change that of a larger multi-service organization. I was part of creating the Altair ACO some 6 years ago, which now includes 13 member organizations who serve roughly a third of all people with HCBS waivers in Minnesota. They took advantage of a series of federal SIM grants offered to states in the early years to build the infrastructure of the ACO. Then they advocated for and eventually applied for funding from the HCBS Innovation Pool, which has paid incentives to the member organizations for several years now every time a person lives or works in an integrated setting in the community that is outside of a group home or a sheltered workshop. The Altair members have learned a lot together over the years and even moved toward a common health information exchange technology that would allow them to integrate healthcare and community services, measure health outcomes, and respond to daily patient alerts. It was very hard at first to find healthcare partners to work with them in this dual eligible Medicaid-Medicare population, but eventually they've broken through that barrier and signed contracts with health plans and added Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare as a member. Altair received a national grant from the Anchor Disability Network to work with DHS to imagine how services should move forward for people with disabilities in Minnesota and how they should be paid for. This led to a bill that passed last session to fund a consultant to explore moving Minnesota toward value-based incentives for the whole provider sector. Value-based payments could provide the incentives for providers to move forward toward updating their services while helping us learn what works and what doesn't through the collection of outcomes data. Some community members have suggested that the provider sector in Minnesota has not changed in decades. That is not the whole story. I learned recently, for example, that 20,000 people under age 65 with disabilities receive PCA services in Minnesota. When combined with the 34,000 people with waivers who receive services in their home, roughly 73% of people with disabilities in Minnesota receive services in their own homes. The Anchor grant that the Altair ACO received put them in a national cohort of other states exploring new models at the cutting edge of innovation in this space. They were envious of the kinds of innovation happening in Minnesota. They also learned through that work and the HMA consultant report funded by ANCOR that states that made dramatic moves to cut costs quickly, with cost as the primary goal, often disrupted services with sweeping negative consequences. While states that have moved more deliberately and thoughtfully continue to move services forward, combining health care and community services while measuring outcomes and costs without jarring disruption in service. We've also been careful to intentionally transition the way people are served in using restraints and seclusion. Since 2017, we've seen a nearly 50% reduction in the use of restraint and seclusion at the Minnesota Security Hospital. This did not happen by accident, but as a result of a commitment to reducing restraints and concerted efforts to bring these numbers down. As we transition these services, we also need to account for the cost and time it takes to shift organization business models. I'm grateful for the DWRS rate-setting system that includes regular inflationary increases. And we need to monitor the workforce shortage and determine whether those built-in increases are enough to keep the provider sector stable through change. I'm also very grateful to the competitive workforce factor that was passed last year. As I began in my role as Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, I could see that we had a list of projects ahead of us, including the DWRS rate setting system as it moves post-banding, continue to improve and simplify the MnChoices assessment system, implementing electronic visit verification, and Waiver Reimagined, designed to simplify our complex waiver system. We also need to move forward with more effective models of self-directed and PCA home care. There's a lot on the plate. And so I've appointed Doug Annett, who comes to us with 20 years of operational management at Provider Opportunity Partners, to a new Deputy Assistant Commissioner role. And Natasha Merz has stepped up from within the department as the Director of Disability Services, reporting to Doug. They both report to the very capable Assistant Commissioner Gertrude Matumba-Mutasa, who also manages our Behavioral Health Division. In other words, I'm doubling the investment in leadership for services for people with disabilities. This is also the first time the DHS Commissioner has come from this provider sector. They still have a lot on their plate, and I'd ask you to be patient and help them to prioritize all that work. They are also surrounded by advocates from the ARC, the Disabilities Law Center, ARM, and more provider associations and the Best Life Alliance partners, the Olmstead Subcabinet, the Governor's Council on Disability, Developmental Disabilities, and the Ombudsman Offices. In addition, at least seven major strategies for people with disabilities are being forwarded through the work of the Blue Ribbon Commission. The state of Minnesota needs to continue to integrate people with disabilities into its own workforce. After it was brought to my attention, several stories of people who said they did not feel as if DHS made an effort to accommodate their needs, I met with our employee resource group for people with disabilities, as I'm doing with all of our employee resource groups, and asked them, how is it to have a disability and work at DHS? I sat back and took notes, learning that some people have had challenges being included in the work of the department, and others have done well. A typical comment was, my last job was tough, but my new manager is amazing. When our hour was up, I thanked everyone for all I'd learned and then apologized on behalf of the entire baby boom generation. I told them that we had gone to work learning to accommodate ourselves to the workplace, and now they are challenging us to accommodate the workplace to employees, and we have a lot to learn. It just so happened as I walked out of that meeting, I went right into a planning meeting for our 2020 all DHS managers meetings. So I instructed our planning team to put accommodations training back on the agenda of our next managers meeting. The governor, as do I, deeply appreciates people with disabilities being employed in state government. However, we understand it's not enough just for our leaders to recognize the importance of programs like Connect 700, but also that all managerial levels within our agencies do as well. The administration hopes to use the work that we've done within state agencies that have done well as a model for how other agencies can ensure that all people are valued and respected in state government. We're at a very exciting point, I believe, in the history of services for people with disabilities in Minnesota. I look forward to working with you and all the other stakeholders to move Minnesota along to new models that further integrate people with disabilities into our communities with better health, fuller lives, and lower cost. We won't know what the governor will have in his budget till March after the February forecast is out. Many ideas and proposals are under discussion. It'll be hard to assess what we can do till we know the state of the budget with the next forecast. Since it's not a budget year, I'm equally focused on what we can bring to the 2021 session to improve the lives of people with disabilities. I look forward to bringing the work of the disabilities group within DHS, new approaches of community providers, ideas from advocates, and the work of our value-based model consultant forward this year to give people with disabilities the opportunity to live and work in ever more integrated settings in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions from members? Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Commissioner. Early in the presentation, you mentioned community homes with staff for people with disabilities, and you had a phrase, you said, providing twice the life for half the cost. I'm wondering if you could say more about that, what twice the life looks like, and where some of the cost savings are coming from in that particular model.
Thank you. Chair Schultz, Representative. I was referring to people that are moving into four-person group homes from settings like regional treatment centers, crisis hospitals, and other critical intense services. And so twice the life is to be able to live out in the community with a few people on a neighborhood street rather than living in a hospital. And half the cost is what it turns out to be roughly, or and can be, depending on how everything's structured, how many people are in the home, etc. My very favorite story is this one person that we know who moved from a regional treatment center into a group home in the community with 24/7 two people staffing one person. After about a month, when he relaxed in the community, they reduced to one person staffing 24 hours a day. That gentleman eventually got a job in the community. He got married and now uses zero state paid services. As it turns out, that particular backstory is he probably never should have been in the regional treatment center in the first place. But other people have moved out of these very intense settings into group homes in the community and, again, cut our expenses dramatically. And, of course, living out in the community on a neighborhood street is the twice the life comment. Thank you.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, can you talked about Altier. Can you explain that a little bit better? And then how is it spelled?
Okay.
Commissioner?
Chair Schultz and Representative, it's Altair, Altair. It's the name of a star,
okay.
Where the name came from. a few years ago when the HCBS Innovation Pool became available, a group of providers that had come together to talk about how they could do work together and share resources applied for those dollars and became both an IHP and an ACO. And so they meet regularly. They've combined some of their databases into a combined health information exchange so that people who work for them can communicate with healthcare. They can communicate with between residential services and employment services. So, for example, Jim doesn't show up at work one day. Three cell phones go off. Where's Jim? He's at home. Why is he home? He's sick. Why is he sick? He ran out of his meds. Now, this part's not together yet, but the intention is a ping to Walgreens, a ping to Amazon, Jim gets his meds and Jim goes back to work. But that interaction between workplace and home is already getting put together in that group of providers. And so they've achieved both ACO status and integrated health partnership status, working together with an intention to combine healthcare with community services with this kind of communication network that provides some really great integrated monitoring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when I look at my sheltered facilities that people live at home, go to work during the day, they're doing a similar thing. Are we running on a track of two same things, or am I not catching something here?
Commissioner?
Chair Schultz, Representative, I'm not sure. Opportunity Partners and LifeWorks both ran workshops and were part of the Altair ACO. So those are two providers that provide this kind of service that combines with their residential services. There may be others in the state doing similar work.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I want to start by telling you just three really short stories and then ask my question. Mm-hmm. So if you'll just bear with me. In my In my work at the Capitol, I have been fortunate enough to meet some very very intelligent, very capable young individuals who've had spinal cord injuries. And they're very concerned about their PCAs. Without the ability to eat by themselves, without the ability to toilet themselves, or the ability to roll over at night, they're very concerned that not having a PCA 24/7 is a matter of life and death for them. So I would like for us to keep them in mind. The second story is a man who is in his middle years of age who was born with profound disabilities, and he has been in a four-person group home. And he had one-to-one care because of the severity of his disabilities, and now he is on a two-to-one care structure due to the ability to hire help and also the ability to pay for help. And then the last story I would like to tell you is a meeting that I had with a father whose son is in a four-person home in our community of Plymouth. And he said to me, and I'll never forget these words, "My plan for my son cannot be that he dies the day before me." So we need to figure out this long-term care workforce shortage system situation that we face ourselves in. So those are the three concerns that are coming to me most readily. But I wanted to ask you, what do you think that we can do to make things better, besides things that you talked about? What are the things that you see where we can make improvements? What's really working well, and really, where do we need to step up?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner?
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative. I think one of the most exciting possibilities is this integration of community service and healthcare. It's something that we talk about a lot, but only in recent years have organizations put contracts in place to really work with each other to tackle the possibilities of better health and fuller life. And I think there's, as we put those two together, there's opportunities for cost savings that give people better health, give people fuller life. We've also seen, for example, at the Altair ACO, that better health and fuller life lead to lower costs, like the example I shared a few minutes ago. So I'm excited about that on the upside. When it comes to making what you've suggested work for everyone in Minnesota, and how are we going to sustain this these models of care, I was delighted to get the data just before I presented today that 73% of people in Minnesota already served in their own homes. And we need to continue to develop models where people are able to be served either in their parents' homes or in host family homes or in their own homes or apartments as ways of providing even better, more integrated lives at lower cost. The other alternative is to pay a lot more for these services to be sure that we can get through that workforce shortage and staff these facilities and these services well. That's not an easy answer, as you know. There's a workforce shortage in every job category in Minnesota, and that's a tough side. And so I think the more we can develop new models is our best answer, but there will be people who will need support in group home settings, and that will simply cost more.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner, for your presentation. I've been learning more about policy at the intersection of public safety and mental health. You mentioned something in your presentation about a 50% reduction in restraints. Mm-hmm. What is your approach in policy around balancing worker safety, because you mentioned a shortage of workers and hard to find workers, with treating patients humanely, whether it's solitary confinement or restraints, and kind of balancing that so that everybody has kind of an equal voice, if you could speak to that.
Yeah, Chair Schultz and Representative, our services don't use the term solitary confinement, but we do have time out and places for people to relax. And that is a tough, tough question, and it's a tough, tough science and art to try to get that balance. Both are absolutely true. We have employees in tougher, more dangerous situations all the time, with a workforce shortage. And we have an attempt more and more every year to try to have fewer restraints on people that we're working with. And getting the two balanced and getting it all right is very, very difficult. I'm very proud of the people at our security hospital that have reduced restraints by 50%, though you may have seen that we were reported with a maltreatment case just last week. And to have employees on the spot and in a quick situation make quick judgments and remember their training and understand whether or not it's all right to restrain when they think there's imminent danger to themselves or the other staff or the other people served is a very tough thing to do in the moment. I was also very proud of a trip I took to the Baxter Behavioral Health Hospital, one of my first trips to visit sites. And they showed me the dark and quiet room with a restraining chair that people can be taken to, and they'd used it once in the last 2 years. I am utterly awestruck at the employees who can be trained to de-escalate behaviors, especially in some of these intense settings, not restrain people, and make things work. I've been told sometimes that I have the toughest job in state government. I think those people have the toughest jobs in state government. And to see them do that work is just literally amazing. But it's a constant daily balance of trying to find the difference between safety for employees and not restraining the people we support and serve. I think the best thing that's happened is simply the awareness, the training, the realization that we don't want to restrain people unless we absolutely have to, and then all the training and the work and the experience that's gone into that has reduced these restraint incidents in an increasingly difficult environment. So we'll just keep that up and keep at it.
Thank you. Representative Gruenhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks for your presentation again. Yeah, just my question was along the same line as Representative Munson's in terms of the safety and the employees. You know, I think it was last session in HHS, we had a video of a woman employee who was who had been put into a coma because she had been beat up by one of the residents down at St. Peter. So I do think some of the employees on an optional basis should have the ability to defend themselves in some cases. There were several stories of very disruptive and abusive behavior, and myself and Representative Lunan at the time, so it must have been two sessions ago, went down to St. Peter to meet with one of the head people there. We spent a couple hours with them and took a tour, but they basically have to call a police person, you know, on the facility that's on the hill, and they have to wait for them to show up. Well, by that time, 5, 10, 15 minutes can go by. I mean, somebody could do a lot of damage in that period of time. So I really, I had a bill, but it ran into some type of a law to give employees the ability to defend themselves on an optional basis, including to carry a taser. Not that you mandate it, but that they have that option. And, you know, I think we need to balance that as much as possible. I'm glad that restraints are reduced, but I do have a very strong concern for the employee safety based upon the testimony we had a couple of sessions ago. Mm-hmm. If you want to respond to that, I got one other question.
Do you want to comment on his
just
comment?
Briefly, Chair Schultz and Representative, we don't operate on a zero restraint policy. We operate on a policy of no restraint unless someone is deeply concerned about their safety or the safety of other residents or other staff. And then a lot of training goes into that, making those judgments. I'll check into the facility on the hill and having to call the police. I'm not quite sure where they draw the line on that one. Let you know.
And then just one other follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, to what degree, and I'm thankful that we're moving people out of facilities into a home care situation. I think it's for their benefit, and also in terms of reducing costs, it's kind of a win-win situation. But at what, you know, we have a growing number of homeless people in this state, right? And are some of these people that are suffering from mental or even physical disabilities falling through the cracks and winding up homeless on the street when we have so many programs to try to address it? Do we have a handle on that at all?
Commissioner?
Chair Schultz and Representative, that is a very good question that crosses several different areas, and I'm not sure. I do know that in the day that the regional treatment centers were closed, people with developmental disabilities were given the opportunity to live in four-person homes on residential streets and given day centers to go to, three square meals a day, et cetera, whereas people with mental illness were given very little. And that has led to some of the homelessness that we see today. And so balancing out the way we serve those populations needs to be done. There are many more services today available for people with mental illness, but it remains a good question as to how well we're serving the whole population.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Commissioner. I know we'll have a lot of questions this session about the improvement of the Mend Choices program and to reduce the inconsistencies and disparities across geographic areas by county in the Mend Choices system, how we can improve that assessment, reduce mm-hmm. the cost of assessment. And I know Senator Abler is going to want to work on addressing group homes and move to more self-directed and individual homes in the community. So we look forward to working with you this session, and thank you for tackling DHS as a commissioner. We know you have a lot on your plate, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
And our last guest is Dan Paula, Assistant Commissioner at DHS in Continuing Care. And you should have a slide deck, members, in your pack, or maybe we don't have a slide deck. Do we have a slide deck on there? They brought copies with them, so they'll be passed out.
Madam Chair, Dan Pollack, Assistant Commissioner for DHS. It's hard to play cleanup after two stellar testimonies from two of my favorite commissioners. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care for Older Adults. Happy to be back here. Sort of feels like jumping back in the cold lake after in a couple months. So just to kind of remind everybody, the Continuing Care for Older Adults Administration is part of DHS. We're the part that is really responsible for the payment of long-term care services. We spend about $1.5 billion in state and federal funds for a variety of different services that I'll talk about. And a large part of what we're doing is trying to serve people before they ever get to Medicaid. So 400,000 older adults in Minnesota come to us for some level of services. Many of them don't end up in Medicaid, and we don't want them to end up in Medicaid if they don't have to. But those that do, 34,000 receive elderly waiver, and about 22,000 are in skilled nursing facilities, although the number in Medicaid in a nursing home is actually even lower than that. And then we also operate the senior linkage line through our partners of the Minnesota Born Out of Aging some of the other community-based services. We're continuing to prioritize equity, which I'll talk about. We're continuing to prioritize strengthening our county and tribal adult protection systems. One of the complex things to think about in this structure that we have, as Commissioner Malcolm was talking to you about the work that MDH, the very important work that MDH is doing and has been improved upon by last year's legislation, that's really only one-third of the equation of the older adult protection systems that MARC handles, the Adult Abuse Reporting Center that Commissioner Malcolm alluded to. So that's just really one piece of the whole overall system. This is just a little illustration of the spectrum of services. As you look, as your eye moves from left to right, what you're really seeing is dramatically increasing cost per person in the type of service and the access to the service. So on the far sort of left side, the Minnesota Board on Aging is administering the Older Americans Act. That's federal funds. You can access that through the Senior Linkage Line or through a AAA, which are regional. If you haven't had an opportunity to sit down with the AAA near your district, it's a great resource to remind older adults and constituents about, because you don't have to go through a spend down. You don't have to declare your income and your assets. You can just access resources in your own community. So from my perspective, that's really the best value for our money as a state, for the taxpayers, and also for our work as DHS. We want people to be able to stay in community and think about what resources might be at that OAA level. Moving to the right, we have the essential communities.
Can I interrupt?
Yes.
So, sure. Assistant Commissioner Pollack, do we exhaust all of those federal funds that were allocated to Minnesota?
Madam Chair, I believe we do. It's a lot of it goes out to those AAAs as grants through the Minnesota Board on Aging. And as far as I know, we do expend all the funds that we receive. I know there's a reauthorization that the U.S. Senate is contemplating right now, and I don't believe it's gotten to the president yet, that will increase some elder justice funding. We were pretty pleased. I think that's a very bipartisan bill, and I think it's going to get a lot of support in Congress. So there's maybe some potential for some new resources, but today, sitting here today, I don't have those details.
Okay, thank you.
So just a couple differentiations of what these other programs are. The Essential Community Supports Program is a very small in number of people, and essentially says if you don't quite have the acuity necessary for nursing home care, we'll still offer you a set of in-home services like meal delivery, some home care services, some chores, very low dollar, high return on investment. And again, you don't have to leave your home for that. The alternative care program, again, is adding to that list. And it isn't necessarily residential services yet, but you might be on your way. So it's somebody who doesn't quite qualify for Medicaid yet, but might be about 6 months away in their spend down. And once you get to these programs, you are having to go through the county. Elderly waiver is our most robust alternative to nursing home care that is meant to be services in residential settings like assisted living. Customized living is the terminology. It can be 24 hours customized living, but it also offers an entire array of other services that maybe might be lower cost. And I'll talk a little bit more about the challenges of that program. And then nursing home care, as I'm sure you're all familiar with, is our highest level, highest cost. That's the institutional level of care. As a state, we continue to transition away from nursing home settings for the primary source of long-term care. We're down to about 360 statewide, still majority nonprofit. But there are a lot of changes happening in this industry, and there are changes in ownership that are happening at an incredible pace. So just in the last 5 years, we've seen about a 25% shift in the ownership. That's 86 changes in ownership that the Department of Health processes, and then we have to change who we're paying. And that can be disruptive and can also change the tone and the quality of the care, for good or for bad. And obviously spending increasing in this area is still growing quite dramatically at about $600 million forecasted. And even despite the fact that we're putting more money into the rates and spending more, we are unfortunately seeing about foreclosures a year. I know in some communities the loss of a nursing home and the closure can be incredibly disruptive and depressing and be the loss of economic vitality and the loss of a resource.
And so, are those closings due to vacant beds not being able to fill beds or because reimbursement rates?
Madam Chair, it's hard to generalize because each one is kind of specific. In some cases, you might still have municipal-owned nursing homes that they don't want to operate anymore. But I would say, and I think the providers would agree to me, that there do tend to be occupancy issues driving closure and perhaps staffing and costs as well. Assisted living continues to be a growth industry, although I think you appropriately were asking some of the questions that are in the forefront of our mind, which is how will the licensing law, which is still in development, interact with the growth of the industry, and certainly from our perspective, it's important to maintain access to that lower level of care. Just a couple updates on what we're implementing on nursing facility policy. There isn't a lot of new law from last session, just a couple of pieces. We did add to the quality score measure a change in how we report into the nursing home report card to include short-term stay. That's an important metric to be measuring on for consumers because so many nursing home stays are short-term, fewer than 90 days. So that is now incorporated in the nursing home report card. We are implementing some new funding that the legislature approved for moratorium exception projects, which are really capital improvement projects that are a great opportunity for facilities to do something important for their physical plant. And then as part of that, a clean energy pilot initiative that I think Representative Cleavorn might have been alluding to. It's very small right now. I think it's only $250,000 as a competitive RFP, but certainly room for growth in the future if it's successful. And then as those projects happen, they will be assessed at a fair market rental value-based approach for the property rate reimbursement. And then I just did want to touch on the PIP program, which is a longstanding quality improvement program in nursing homes. We're a couple weeks, I think, away from announcing a new round. That's something we do annually, which is a 5% add-on on the rate for quality improvement. I'd be remiss if I didn't draw attention to the importance of equity in our work. This is important in the long-term care space, even though I don't think it's traditionally has been as well recognized or understood in how it interacts. And different communities are experiencing aging in different ways. And so we as a service payer, overwhelming service payer, are trying to understand and adapt to different communities' needs and desires for healthy aging. One thing that has struck us as potentially concerning is that the PCA program, the home care services that our colleagues in the disability division operate, is 61% people of color, and that level of diversity is very different from what we see at the residential setting level. So people based with different races are choosing different settings for the care that might be by choice or it might be because of structural barriers. So we're trying to determine whether the process that we've created for accessing Medicaid, for accessing long-term care services, in of itself creates some challenges for different communities. So for example, if you grew up in a community that had a very difficult relationship with the county sheriff or the county itself, perhaps you had an out-of-home placement, are you likely to divulge intimate details of your life story to a county assessor or intake worker in order to access those services, or are you likely to never ask for help even? So just some of the questions that we're thinking about. And I think Representative Grunhagen's question about homelessness was actually very interesting and appropriate, and something that I'm particularly concerned about. I actually participated in the point in time count this year through the Wilder Foundation, where we go out onto the street, and the governor himself actually came, which was a surprise to all of us, but it was really exciting. And we actually are talking to people, you know, why are you riding the light rail, and why aren't you in housing, and what's kind of going on? And there is a lot of older adult homelessness in the state. That's actually one of the fastest growing areas. And we don't have data yet. I don't think we have a good answer for why it's growing. But one thing that does concern me is that this does relate to the number of people who have had criminal justice experience and perhaps have a felony for something, maybe even decades ago, and are having trouble finding housing. So it's just it's an appropriate question, and I'd love to have that dialogue with you. The Elderly Waiver as a program faces some considerable challenges, and this photo on the right is actually a consumer guide that we just published, I think, in January. If any of you want it for your office or for your constituents, we're happy to provide it for you. It's a full-color sort of how-to guide of what is the Elderly Waiver, what it can offer for you. Certainly workforce challenges are present there just because of the economy and because the work is hard. And the wages are having a hard time keeping up with the demand. And I would, you know, also say that the rates probably have a big role in that as well. Certainly we're seeing growth in higher cost settings and limited access in some of those settings, and increased complexity of participants. We know 43% have mental illness and 36% have behavioral health concerns. That's just in the Elderly Waiver program. That's not Medicaid-wide. So we do see spending increasing a lot. The one piece that we're implementing from last session that is trying to get at this question of access is a quality improvement grant program. I think this was originally envisioned as more of a rate increase bill, but it ended up just being a small $1 million quality improvement grant. So we'll be announcing that shortly in the next month, I would say, for a couple of providers that are sort of going above and beyond. They're at 75% or more of their residents on Medicaid, which is a very tough a payer mix to be handling. We are implementing the Assisted Living Report Card, which we appreciate the legislature authorizing last year. It's a really important piece of the quality question going forward. It really represents a consumer research survey of 60,000 people, residents themselves and their family members. A partnership with the University of Minnesota and some of their PhDs is producing the metrics, and they've produced a 150-page research document, which I'm happy to share if you'd like to read, how we're designing the metrics for quality. And they just in January also published the stakeholder engagement research, which is another 50 pages or so of data based on an 822-person online survey, 13 public presentations, a 266-person statewide live stream event, 5 focus groups. And so we're spending a lot of time to get this right. And I hope as you see it rolling out and hear from constituents and providers that you're happy with the direction that's going in. The report card itself will be based on 9 components of quality, measuring those and rating individual providers on those metrics. And for purposes of time, I won't run through all of them, but I'm happy to do follow-ups on that.
At least some of those PhDs or graduate students will turn this into their dissertation, and they can evaluate it after it's been implemented.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think some of them already have their dissertations and might be going for a second one on this. As Commissioner Malcolm mentioned, the Office of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care is a key partner. Cheryl Hennon, who most of you know, is independent of me, but is a close colleague and is housed at the Anderson Building and works with us. I know she's been staffing up based on the new funding that was approved by last year's legislature. My understanding is she's hired about 8 of the new 17 and has about 9 more to go in terms of hiring for the next calendar year. They are taking on a tremendous amount of work because a lot of the pieces of the new law where we said, how are we going to do this, the answer ended up being, well, the ombudsman will do it, and they're a real trusted partner. So electronic monitoring, as you know, started January 1st. Some of the other work that they're doing is monitoring eviction notices to really make sure we're handling that properly, and then other issues of abuse and prevention. The ombudsman also is a really good resource, again, if somebody doesn't necessarily want to file a MARC complaint but just has concerns about the quality or the service that they're having that don't rise to that level. Or if they do rise to that level, you can call them for that as well. It's kind of an everyman for all your needs. So specifically on MARC, we did receive a number of new initiatives funded to improve the MARC system, and this is the entry point that all complaints come to, whether you live in a licensed setting or not. And just to give you a sense of the scale, those MDH complaints that Commissioner Malcolm mentioned are only about a third of the work. 55% of the complaints and the allegations coming into MARC are really at the adult protection level, which means a person living in community, not in a licensed setting, typically their own home. And those percentages break down as 32% caregiver neglect. These are the allegations. 19% self-neglect, really somebody who is having trouble taking care of themselves. 18% financial exploitation, and then emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, smaller numbers, thankfully. What we're doing with the new funding is improving the system, improving its communication, particularly with law enforcement agencies. We know that criminal complaints really have to be handled seriously and quickly, so we're building some of the transmission and communication there. You heard about the SSIS case management system. The funding of adult protection grant activities started in October, although unfortunately none of it is going to tribes yet. We're still working with the tribes to make sure that that's a possibility. And so a lot of these projects are kind of ongoing and will be continued to work on over the calendar year. Looking forward, I did just want to highlight for you a project that we're doing that's really at the engagement phase. This is not a proposal for the 2020 session, but as we have implemented some of these system improvements, one of the questions that has come up and really was not addressed last year at all is the Vulnerable Adult Act for the state. So that is our state law protection and guides all of these different processes that we use to investigate complaints and allegations. Well, the Vulnerable Adult Act has not been updated for about 40 years. And so one of the things that we've tried to do is ask, is this a law that really really lives in the 21st century and really puts people at the person who is the vulnerable adult at the center, or is it a little bit anachronistic in a sense of somebody has to be arrested, somebody has to go off to jail? We want to know what's the vulnerable adult themselves want to happen. We want to improve the law and give some more flexibility probably to counties and to lead investigative agencies like MDH to be saying to the older adult, what is it that you would like to see? Maybe there was a criminal act against you and somebody should go to jail. Maybe it's something that is much sort of lower level in terms of more misdemeanor type crime. And in that case, we wouldn't want to necessarily incarcerate your caregiver. That might be a family member. That might be somebody that you just want to have provide you better care and not be, doing stupid things in your house. So there's a spectrum, and the Vulnerable Adult Act engagement process is hundreds of hours of conversations with those stakeholders about what should we change and how. So that's something that maybe will be coming next year, depending on how the research goes. I wanted to end on a kind of fun note. The governor signed an executive order in partnership with AARP in December, and we just announced the appointments for that. This is a council, a public-private partnership that's going to be doing some work outside of the Capitol and some of the communities that you all are from that have already really been leading at the municipal and county level with the idea of an age-friendly community. So we're trying to move towards an age-friendly state. And that's broader than human services or healthcare. It's really about what is it that a city like Alexandria has done or Maple Grove or Northfield to become more age-friendly. Could be changing their street crossings. It could be providing more sidewalks. It could be providing better transit access, providing more employment opportunities on a part-time basis for people who are close to who have just retired and maybe don't necessarily want to be out of the workforce altogether. So a lot of opportunity for conversations, and we'll be trying to make sure that there's some greater Minnesota meetings for this council as well. And I think that's going to wrap it up, and happy to take questions on any of these topics.
Thank you. Any questions? Quick question. Representative Brunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks for the presentation. You know, I have a bill here that I'm going to introduce, and it just encourages or requires some notification of next to family members that if they care for the person who's certified to be in a nursing home, they can actually be reimbursed for that care. My understanding is we already have the law on the books. But I just had a recent experience during the interim. My mother-in-law had very serious surgery. She's 94 years old, and she lived with us about 2 to 3 months as she was recovering. And we had a social worker and public health nurses stop out to make sure that you know, she was receiving the type of care and treatment that she needed while she was at home. But she easily could have been certified to be in a nursing home. And but no one ever mentioned once that that my wife could be reimbursed for taking care of her. And I found out actually in December, I think it was in Arizona, New Mexico, they've really advocated this. And when we look at the cost projections with the baby boomers coming up, it seems like it's growing simply at a rate that is unsustainable. And we've had, you know, assessments to actually conclude that, Tom Gillespie, former state demographer, and others. So I really believe that we need, just like the disability presentation, you know, where we move people out of the facilities into a home setting is the key to reforming this situation and still meeting the needs. And people say, well, abuse can happen at home. Well, we've had abuse here too, okay, in the nursing homes. So I just would really appreciate your input and thoughts on that, especially when nursing homes are closing and people don't want their loved ones to be, you know, 50, 60 miles away from them or further as we proceed here. So if you have any comments, I'd appreciate it.
Commissioner Pollack?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I think it's a very strong idea. It's something we're happy to provide technical assistance on and take a look at. Certainly family members often are more knowledgeable and competent in terms of the care that the older adult may want. And all I would add is maybe making sure they could have paid leave from other employment might be important as well.
Yeah. Madam Chair?
Quickly.
Yeah, real quick. You know, I've sold long-term care insurance, and I have a lot of Medicare supplement clients. And, you know, a lot of people say I'd rather die than go in the nursing home, okay? So I do think it's something that's a good alternative. And there are people who would in the family that would help them, but they can't afford to stay home to do it. And since we do have a law to allow that, I do think we need to explore that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had Mr. Pollack, I had an email recently from a woman. She and her husband had been living in an assisted living, well, no, he was just senior housing in my district. And she said they no longer in my district. Her husband needed to be put in a separate facility. And then she is like in another facility about a mile away. And I'm thinking, I mean, that just seems like such a difficult thing to do, that we should be looking at better ways that families can stay together. Just a comment.
Thank you. I agree. So I think we need to work with our housing agencies to make sure we're creating the housing that works for keeping people together throughout their life cycle. So thank you, Commissioner Pollack, for joining us. Really great information. Looking forward to working with you this session. And the division is adjourned. We will meet next Monday at 12:45.